You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Today, in our February episode with the sun freshly in Pisces, we welcome Simone Baldacci to the podcast. Simone is one of the many talented contributors to Hadean Press's Conjure Codex series, and today we settle down to talk about his essay, Mother, Daimones, and Goetia, Ecstasy and Civilization. Together we go over the speculative origins of the wandering Goes, tackling the far broader and more encompassing definition of the title, and the various species of daimones which can be found threaded through ancient sources which connect them. Being a blacksmith and metalworker, Simone offers his insights into the nature of metal, the forge, and its qualities and virtues in its various physical and mythic forms. We also discuss the difficulty in distinguishing between the underworld and the celestial in ancient thought, the great mother goddess, and much, much more. To appease the gods of the algorithm, we ask that you like, subscribe, and share our work so that we can continue our ongoing project of spotlighting our many wonderful authors. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I introduce Simon Baldacci to the Hadean Press Podcast. Hello, Simone. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Matt. Thank you for the invite, and it's very nice to be here with you.
Simone, could you tell us a little about yourself and how you became interested in the subject of magic and the occult?
Well, to be honest, that's not a particularly interesting story. I wish it could be, but well, for most of my life, I wavered between atheism and agnosticism. I had a very strong socialist and Marxist ideological background. And so I have to admit freely that religion felt to me as repellent like garlic to vampire. And I saw spirituality purely as a philosophical or education or psychological tool for personal development and transformation, and nothing more. Then at some point, it started suddenly, so to speak. Like less than 10 years ago, I attended a medieval fair where I saw someone reading tarot cards. And then I started talking with friends who were studying esotericism, were tied to Freemasonry, very light stuff. And then I found myself suddenly feeling like unexpected emptiness inside. Like I started questioning more insistently whether there was something beyond the mechanistic view of the universe. And so that need eventually turned into a sort of, Pascal Wegener, like the philosopher Pascal. So I said to myself, I will either prove it to myself, the existence of a spiritual reality, or I will try to spend my life to try and see if it was true or not. So, of course, this drive, this desire, in the first few years, it led me to experiment in many ways, most of them unsuccessfully or sporadic, and encountering all the bad, you know, that we find in the occult. So cult leader and charlatan, things that were driven exclusively by marketing and money. But, I didn't have any guidance, any compass, any moral and magical compass. So I tried everything. But in this journey, this weird and unsuccessful journey, the first certainty, the first milestone I had was when I discovered that my spiritual journey was deeply connected to the forge and iron. This was something that came up very early in my path, where it's hard to explain how it happened. I'd say that I started digging into myself, and at some point I found this buried chest, and in this chest was this vocation, this calling to the spirit of the forge, to the spirit connected to blacksmithing and to metal. And this vocation, this calling, is still driving me today. I read recently an article about the concept of telemas, pure will or true will. And I think somehow that my true will, so to speak, is metal, is somehow connected to this revelation of my personal destiny and my personal mission, if you want to say it that way. Well, the second milestone, which is probably right now the main one, is when I encountered the voodoo of the 21 division, which is the voodoo practiced in the Dominican Republic. And this tradition is something that today, after like 5 years, takes like 90% of the time I dedicate to magical practice. And it is some, well, being connected to a living tradition that is so strong, so magical, so syncretic, and open to different influences, has really informed my view of magic and radically changed my understanding of, I mean, in this talk, we will of course speak about Goetia, and if the people who listen to us has read my article, my essay on Conjure Codex, will probably find differences, because my path into voodoo has led me to reconsider some stuff and to see things. I'm not trying to make a forced connection. It's just that my experience into a living tradition has changed my understanding of certain data we gather from ancestries.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to getting into that with you. So, as you mentioned, we're here today to talk about your excellent essay, Mother, Demones, and Goetia, Ecstasy and Civilization, which is published in Hadean's Conjure Codex, Volume 5. Before we get into the meat of your essay, then, for our audience, could you define the actual meaning of Goetia?
I can try, but I think that the best approach for the people who listen is not like to treat this answer like a definition. You know, I think that understanding the meaning of Goisha is part of the path to the path into Goisha as a magical tradition itself. Because Goisha, even after years and years of research, still defies an exact definition. So the process of defining this word, I think, is part of the magical path, because as you define what is Goisha for you, you define your context, your spiritual, magical, psychological, symbolical context that you give to Goisha. You know, like it's like you are a sculptor, no? Like Michelangelo, the sculptor, he says, I don't sculpt a stone. I remove, I uncover what is trapped in the stone. I think it's similar. Defining Goisha for oneself is like finding what's trapped in this stone. And as you define the shape of this world, of this context, you are defining your relationship with this path. But back to a more focused approach, it's good to know that we don't have texts, ancient texts, in which we have an author that explicitly explain what those that are called Goes or Goethes, that is the name of the practitioner of Goisha, what they actually did. We don't know.
In your essay, you say it's a tautology. A Goes performs Goisha.
Yeah, because the word Goisha, even Jake noticed this, that the word Goisha is later. So it's not the art that defined the practitioner. It's the practitioner that defined the art. So it's like it's not like you invent woodworking and then you say, oh, there is the woodworker and that's wood. No, first you acknowledge the existence of wood. Then you know you acknowledge the existence of those who work wood, and then abstractly, so it's cognition, it's a later product of abstraction to define a field of competence. So we have to start. To define what Goisha is, it's of least interest. We need to define what Goethes did in the past. That's what we care for. And even etymology, you know, I have seen some men, some essays that say, oh, yes, Goisha derives from a word that define wailing, funeral lament, weeping. And so they extracted from this the idea that Goisha is a tonic sorcery. But, you know, there are other cases where etymology is unreliable. Let me make a quick example. In the south of Italy, in Naples, a word used to define folk healers, or what we could define witches, is cumare. And that word just comes from Latin, cum mater. And this word just defined like a midwife or like a friend of the family. It doesn't have any relationship with the world of magic. So if in the 3000 AD, in 1000 years from now, people will archaeologically or historically try to find the meaning and of Kumare, and they wouldn't find maybe any relationship with the magical context. And that's why etymology, I think, is not reliable.
There's also other connections I think Jake makes with the pharmakos.
Yeah. We have, for example, a splendid witness which I can't recall by memory right now, but I have written about it in my essay. We have an hexameter from Empedocles, a philosopher, and a Goethes, one of the Goethes, which he defined three pillars of Goisha, and that's pharmaka, which is the knowledge of the herbs, the knowledge the magical material. So, and probably a knowledge that bring us in the field of medicinal and magical practice. He then mentioned meteorological magic. So he says, I will teach you to control the weather. And that's a very wide field because the control of the weather could influence politics, could influence war, could influence agriculture, fertility. But what we extract from this is that the practical magic, one of the pillar Gorisha, a magic that is not ethereal and undefined, a magic that is applied to change the physical world and produce this change. And the third point that we find in this hexameter is that he says, I will teach you to transfer, to carry from the world of the dead the strength of the dead man. So we have the fact that you can carry something, an influence from the world of the dead and here, which is another point of the Gorisha, the mediation with the world of the dead and the capacity to work with the mighty dead, heroes, or the recently the deceased.
So they're a liminal figure.
Totally, totally.
They can aid a woman to give birth. They can aid with medicine for the sick, and they can stand as intermediaries with the dead.
Totally. They are the ultimate intermediary because the Goethes were also geographically and socially liminal. That is, they weren't part of the established society.
They were wanderers.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Yeah, and even geographically, that is, we rarely find the mention of Goethes in Athens. We find them in the external region of Greece. We find them in Phrygia, in Crete. We find them in Phoenicia. So in places that in the mind of the Greek writers were part of the were beyond their comfort zone, so to speak. They were in another place, be it mythical or physical.
They may have been barbarians in their
Yeah,
eyes,
exactly.
speaking barbaric tongue in a barbaric tongue.
Yeah, exactly. When, for example, when we find Frisian in a text, it doesn't mean from the actual Frisia. It's like saying barbarian. It's like saying Oriental. You know, it's very generic. Even for example, when we find the costume, you know, the Phrygian cap, the Phrygian attire with the long pants, they are not the custom of Phrygia. They are stereotypes. They are cultural and artifacts, so to speak, to convey a meaning. You know, when people see that cap and that dress, they say, oh, that's Phrygian. That's a barbarian. So, but we know it's from the liminal region, you know, from the border of
Borders.
the known world, so to speak.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for defining that. It's really refreshing to see this more wholesome, more complete definition. Even though the actual definition itself is still so vague, it's so much more, all-encompassing as opposed to simply chthonic and simply working with the dead. It's more. It almost incorporates all aspects of life. So, thank you for explaining that. It was really, really interesting. So, You highlight in your essay many important groups of daimones in the story of archaic Goetia, most notably the dactyls, telkaines, korebantes, the kuretes, and the kaberoi. Could you explain who these groups were and why were they so important? And why are they still so important to our understanding of the evolution of this ancient practice?
Yeah, my idea is that they're important because with what we know about this, what we called Goetia, that's the best bet to identify entities, spirits, and cults that were related to Goetia. Like, if I were to bet, what cult could be a goes tied to? I'd say that spirit, that cult, those mysteries. And that's why I delved into them. And, however, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the people that listen our dialogue, our chat, don't know about this, about the spirit, because they are, I find it fascinating that, like Goetia, they also evade our understanding, because they weren't part of the central scene of writings, of the, they are also part of the fringe world of literature. They stayed in places, we're speaking about literature, but they stayed in places where they weren't easily defined. For example, they weren't part. We find a brief mention in Plato. We don't find a mention of them in most of the tragedy or theater, even if we know there are lost tragedies, for example, about the Kaberoi. They are like the spiritual parallel of Goetia. So we are in the fringe world of literature, of archaeology, but it's like this doesn't need to surprise us, because most of the information of the ancient world is lost. And we always need to have clear in our mind that literary sources most of the time are not reliable of actual reality. Literary sources are extremely biased, and often they have like a parrot mentality. Like, they didn't investigate what they wrote. They just took information from a line of other writer, and they assumed that the knowledge in them was real, which often was not.
And also these characters that we just mentioned, they were ancient when Homer wrote about them, and Homer is one of our oldest sources.
Yeah. For example, we have the earliest literary source that speak about them is from the 7th century BC, but that's a literary source. So when that the source was put into writing, that was probably something that circulated for centuries before, also because it was from a stage play, so that's probably old as theater itself. There are evidence that point to the existence of a relationship between metallurgy and religion that date back to the Mycenaean world, so we are back, very back into the Bronze Age. But who are these daimones? Let's go into the heart of the matter. Mm. You know, they are heroes. Sometimes they are demigods. Sometimes they do not have a clear origin. Sometimes they are in mythology are called autochthonous being. Autochthonous mean they are self-born from the earth. Like they spawn from the earth, from an event. Or sometimes they are the so-called first men, like Adam. But in every case, all these beings are intermediaries. And they mediate in the mind, the spirit, and in the practice from different sides, from different reality. For example, they mediate, as we talked before, between the living and the dead. So they link to the afterlife. They connect past and present because they are often founder of cities, ancestor, founder of a lineage, of a cult, or whatever. So they act as a link with what we define ancestral. They are stand between gods and mortals because they are not always they are gods. For example, even the Dioscuri, Castor and Pollux were defined as daimones, as kaberoi, and we see in their myth that they stay one day in the world of the heaven and one day in the world of the dead. So they are extremely mobile people, entities, so to speak. They are an initiator into mysteries. So they guide, they link the world of the profane, the ordinary world, to the world of the sacred, to the world of what's beyond the mystery. They link the city and what's beyond the city. So they manage the boundary between civilization and nature. They are metallurgists, so they are extremely forces of order, of creation, but one of their feature is the wild dance, the ecstatic dance that they perform in caves, in woods, or even under the sea. So they are forces connected deeply to the forces, to the wildness, to the forces beyond civilization, and they manage this boundary. Many are tied to major deities. So we have myths that connect to these deities. For example, many are connected to the Zeus on Mount Ida, which is the Cretan Zeus, which is not the Olympic Zeus, is another being. They are connected to the birth of the Dionysus, of Poseidon, or Apollo. We may imagine them as part of court of deities. If we had a spirit catalog for these deities, we will find them as subordinates as maybe as a simple spirit or even deputies of these deities. But they have a strong connection to metal, of course, maybe someone has guessed. But if we read older academia, we find that an outdated understanding, like, oh, they were smiths, so they are connected to smiths and smiths' gods. That's not true. Smith deities, spirits of metal, are not exclusive of people who work metal. You may have a stronger bond because that informs your daily experience of life, but that doesn't exclude other people because metal was, so to speak, a metaphor, a very handy and polysemic, with multiple meaning metaphor. So metal could mean political power because people who had reserves of bronze, of tin, of copper could have the power over technology. So politics, the city. Power, metal, of course, is equivalent to military power. Because, of course, you can build weapon and armor. Metal is fertility because you have the capacity to build a tool for agriculture. You have the capacity to shape the wood for ships so you can make trade, you can make commerce. Having metal means this. If we had if we could translate this, for example, into the planetary structure, we could say that metal ties to the planet of Jupiter because that's the metal as political power, metal as abundance and prosperity. Metal ties to Saturn and Venus because they represent the definition of boundaries, agriculture, and fertility. Metal is connected to Mercury because, of course, metal means trade, means building, means idea and creation. Of course, it connects to Mars because it's martial power and the war and whatever. It's fire, of course. And we may is connected to the sun because not this, of course, we can interpret the sun as sort of a cosmic crucible, you know, where the elements are shaped. But I mean, the cosmos is made of metal implements in archaic thinking. You know, the sky is a dome of bronze. The underworld is bound by gates of bronze. There are pillars probably made of metal that surround and uphold the cosmos. So metal is everywhere. Metal is like the primal matter with everything that was built. For example, there are some theories that when we find in some creation meeting, in some cosmogonies, the idea of primordial water, that is not actual water, but that is molten copper. Because when you melt copper, its color is similar to the water at dawn. You know, when the reflection of the sun at dawn give that shining and vibrating color to waters. So the idea that primordial waters, where the waters of creation, where the primal matter is reflected, is mirrored into the idea that copper was the basic of foundry. With copper, you could cast and make every kind of object. So copper is similar to the idea of primal matter. There is a strong bond with this idea.
And of course, the many ancient civilizations' first experience of metal would have been from it falling from the sky in the shape of a meteorite.
Sure. We have we, that, that's why, for example, defining metal as something infernal or auric is limiting. You know, like limiting Goetia, as we said before, in a tonic context, because the ancient people had both experience. You know, they discovered metal through meteorites, which were falling to the earth, but at the same time, they found metal very close to the surface. So it was metal that came out from the earth or even from the rivers. So metal is above and below. And that's why in the cosmogonies we have metal is part of the implements of the underworld and of the sky, because effectively people found metal both below the earth and found that it falls from the sky. So they say, oh yeah, it's everywhere, and that's it. Simple.
I love that, in that the idea of an underworld isn't necessarily directly beneath our feet, but also in the stars, in the sky.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Yeah, I mean that's that I think, for example, that Goetia comes from a time where this kind of abstract thinking were not informing our understanding of the cosmos. I preach against, for example, equating Goetia with the definition of actonic sorcery, because there is no distinction between the sky and the underworld.
Exactly.
It's it's useless, because they are one cosmos. The cosmos is one big living being. So focusing on one aspect is limiting, and I could add even potentially dangerous. For example, in voodoo, in the 21 division, our altar is divided in four parts, like a cross. And these four parts are related to big families of spirit, to make it simple. And you can't work with one, because working with one family will bring you to imbalance in yourself. So you have to work with all the different kind of spirit, because that reflects in you with a balanced approach. You know, for example, we have four family because they are very loosely associated with the four element. So working with one is like working with just one of the four element and ignoring the other one. You can't work with only the chthonic part, because the chthonic world is intertwined, is entangled with the sky and with our land. You know, the idea, the mythical idea that there were three brothers, you know, Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades. The idea that they are brother must be read esoterically or magically, like they are bound by fraternal love. You know, they are bound because they are brothers, so they are linked by blood, and this link cannot be displaced, cannot be separated.
So in your essay, you explain that the heart of the magical mystery dynamic called Gwisha is tied to a structure oriented about a central motherly figure, often flanked by two subordinate male figures. So in your research, what did you find? Who is this mother goddess? Could you elaborate further on this?
Yes, in many of the archaeological contexts of the Kabbalistic mysteries, like Samothrace, Lemnos, Imbros, Thebes, I mean, usually people know only Samothrace, but all the coast of the Eastern Mediterranean was pointed by sanctuaries of this of the great god of Samothrace, which were not always the same, because the sanctuaries weren't like a universal cult. They were local cult. So when we say who was the mother goddess, probably every city has its own answer, because that answer is not informed by a logical statement. It's not like, oh, that writer wrote this. No, that was influenced by the local reality. So the territory, is there a mountain? Is there a sea? Is there a river? And by legend, how did this legend develop? Maybe 1,000 years ago there was a war, and during the war a goddess intervened and helped our cities, and that shaped our legend, our folklore. So everyone gave a different name of this mother goddess. This sometimes it's called like that, Mether Theon, so the mother of the gods. Sometimes it can assume names of deities: Demeter, Rhea, Artemis, Cybele, Persephone, Hecate. But that's not the point. You know, the point, I think, if I were to find the mother goddess of my territory, I have to find it in my territory. It's useless to take one, because who knows? Oh, I like Demeter. Okay, but you have to go out there and see what your land has to offer. And instead, we have this pair of male figure beyond below the mother goddess, which I have to make a small apology, because at the time I thought that two was the main number of these relations. But in further studies, I found that this number may vary. So what we may say is that this mother goddess, these main central pillars of this cult, had around it a cohort of a number of figures, which mostly were males, because they attended the goddess. Like, for example, in the myth of the birth of Zeus, we have one version says that Rhea, sorry for the pronunciation, She digs her finger into the earth, and from this act, five dactyls, and there is a pun here because dactyl mean fingers. So she put the fingers and fingers spawn up. They spawn from the earth, protecting her. And that we have an example. So in this case, they are five. Sometimes they can be three. The number is not fixed, despite that two occurs many times. For example, in Samothrace, we know that Samothrace, according to a version, the rite of Samothrace were given by Demeter or Cybele to a couple of brothers, which were Dardanus and Hetion. Dardanus is like the founder of one of the founder of Troy. Or, for example, the Dioscuri, Castor and Pollux were associated with the mother goddess. Or in Thebes, for example, Demeter transmitted the rites of the Decabeiri to a couple of father and son, which are called Prometheus and Ethneus. Ethneus means E from Mount Etna, which is the volcano of Sicily. In the Argonautica of Apollonius Rhodius, we know that the goddess of the mountain described there has two attendants who are conjured by the Argonauts, and these two attendants are Tityus and Kylenus, which are called dispenser of doom, and they are called to placate the spirit of the dead king of Cyzicus. So, for the modern practitioner, that's not important. The important is that you have this mother goddess which represents the earth. If you were in the PGM, we could call her physis, nature. We could call her simply nature. And then we have those male attendants that somehow are part of the spiritual retinue, like a spirit catalog. We have the mother goddess in the center, and below there we have a retinue of spirits that have different function.
And so what is this link then, do you think, with mountains? Why do we find all these specific gods and goddesses connected to mountains? I mean, it's obvious to everybody who's interested in religion that, Mount Sinai, for instance, that's an important location where God descended to speak to Moses, etc. But why do you think there is this tradition of mountain gods, mountain goddesses?
I think that one focus point, I think, is has a deep historical links, so links, so to speak. Because, for example, when we imagine the people from Sumeria, from the Mesopotamian plain, we say, oh, they live in plains, they are born there. No, people before the advent of agriculture usually lives on mountain, because mountain and woods are environment richer in resources. Plain doesn't offer anything. Plain are just the places where illness, plague, mosquitoes, flood happens. So before agriculture, plains didn't have anything to offer. And people lived in woods and mountain, high up. So I think first that mountain I'd say atavistic, ancestral memory of the place of the beginning where we started, where we developed. And from a magical perspective, mountain are liminal places, because often, for example, in Italy, we have many places that are considered the gates of Avernus, and they are often weird places like swamps, volcanic plains. Somehow, many places are linked to the other, but we must think that mountains are linked to the sky. So, like the cave is the liminal place with the underworld, the mountain is the liminal place with the heavenly gods.
It's wonderful. Even in Japan, we have Mount Fuji, which is considered a god. So it's a universal trait amongst human cultures, I think, that the mountain is this, like you said, this liminal place where you can enter into a dialogue with the spirits or with God. So it's really fascinating. Thank you for that. So could you talk about this idea that you bring up about how the daimones of these cults, they move between the mythical and the historical. So there's this, even in that regard, there's this liminality to these characters.
Yeah. Well, usually daimones belong to a mythical dimension. However, in this case, there are testimonies where these terms, this word I use to describe figure, root in historical reality. The most significant example comes from Plato in its Laws, where he described a ritual that he defined corybantic, a corybantic ritual, which is the Tronosis, which is a ritual probably practiced in Samothrace, part of the initiatic journey, where a person was sit on a chair, and the priest, the magician, the sorcerer, let's call them however we want, but danced around the person on the chair, clashing a drum, and this sound, this music, these bangings produce, of course, in the person in the chair, which was probably also veiled, an ecstatic trance, using a New Age word, we may say a shamanic journey, but so we can understand each other. And this person moved, Plato says that the person exited from his soul. So the soul exits from the body, make a journey, and is cured from mental illnesses. So it's like, you know, you remove some, it's like I remove my hoodie, wash it, and then wear it back, you know? So you remove something from its shell so that it can be cleansed and purified, and then you put it back. So, and this mythical ritual, I mean, this ritual involved reenacting the act of the mythical corybantes, what they once performed, because the corybantes, when they spawn from the earth, when they come to protect these infant gods, that they often are Zeus, but they also could be Dionysus, Apollo, Poseidon, they come and usually perform something, which is, in the case of Zeus, the clashing of their shield. They are armed dancer, and they start clashing their bronze shield with a weapon to produce noise that cover the cries of the infant. So we have, it's like they took from the myth of the Corybantes, of the Dactyl, of the Curetes, an actual ritual. And this makes them exactly like the Corybantes, because they do the same. They are Corybantes on their own when they perform this ritual. It's like, you know, you are embodying through the mythical and ritual act, the Corybantes, this figure, this daimones, they are in you, which is something that act, for example, in voodoo, because in voodoo, when you are possessed by a spirit, you start doing some moves. You start doing some dances that are typical of the spirit. A spirit is identified with its moves, with its gesture, with its, sometimes with it, the way he moves his eyes. So there is.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
It's a clear links between how the body, how the ritual, the body, how you act, and a mythical dimension. That's why I say when this ritual specialist we see in Plato perform Corybantic dance, they are in that moment, they are Corybantes. They are one with the mythical beings. And that's it. In Samothrace, we know that the rites were established there by dactyls. You know, the dactyls come in Samothrace, leave their initiation, the rites, and this start spark the cult. So we have another identification between mythical and historical dimension, because the priest of Samothrace in their office act as mythical reflection of the dactyl. In their capacity as priest, they are dactyl in that moment. And this is reflected, of course, in the cult, where dactyl, where curetes are, you know, engaged ritually, experientially, mystically, to bring this mythical dimension into our ordinary reality.
Yes, I love this stepping into the myth, becoming indistinguishable from the myth in the act of ritual.
Yeah.
Also, I think it's a, if I may add it, it's a very, how do we say, engaging and gratificating reality. You know, it's instead the dry, I call it the dry approach of the grimoires, which is let's make a ton of catalogs and correspondences, because it's like, you know, it's like reading a romance or reading a list of number, like reading the balance. Yeah, like a book of the balance. Okay, let's take the economical balance of Amazon in the year 2024. Wow, how engaging. That must be very cool. Instead, we have from the other part, like reading a romance, a novel, a fable. No, engaging with spirit, with in the mythical dimension means to establish a relationship links.
Yes.
In voodoo, in all the tradition, for example, of South America and Central America, or the Afro-diasporic tradition, spirits are not identified by properties, you know. They are identified by a story first. You know the spirit by their story. Many, for example, in the Espiritismo of Puerto Rico or in Venezuela, many, the spirit are all dead people. They are all dead. When they manifest, I mean, you know their name and their story. They tell you of their mortal life. So that's how you start from their life. You start from the meat, and from the meat, you extract the property of the spirit. If a spirit is a warrior, you can work with him for protection. If a spirit the curetes of Crete are connected to the myth of Crete and Zeus, which dies every year, and in spring is reborn. And when he's reborn, he comes from his cave into the cities, dancing, leaping, and bringing fertility. So when I invoke, I conjure the curetes, the myth tells me, Simone, you can work with the curetes for fertility, because the myth says so.
Wonderful, wonderful. So you mentioned in your essay that there is some connection between the Pythagoreans and the Goetes. Could you expand a little further on that?
This idea was born from one of the scholars that I mostly followed for my studies, which is Sandra Blakely. And she speaks of a strong connection between not only the Pythagorean, but all pre-Socratic philosophy and Goetheia. For example, this connection is expressed mythically through the attribution of the dactyl as initiator in Samothrace of Pythagoras and Orpheus. So the dactyl, the daimones we spoke about, are the milestone, you know, the founding stone, the cornerstone of two of the biggest initiatory schools of antiquity, Pythagoras and Orphism. The same Empedocles, which was declared, which was called Agoes, he lived in Sicily, a place where Pythagorean and Orphic presence was huge. Most of the Orphic laminas of the gold tablet of Orphism are found in Sicily. Even Pythagoras went to Sicily to establish his school. So, and in fact, we find in his philosophy a big influence from both Orphic and Pythagoric school. And we have a strong bias. We are used to thinking of philosopher, thanks, many thanks to a rationalizing culture and the art history that filtered the images of the philosopher through these ideas. We think a philosopher like a rational, a rigorous scholar dedicated to discernment, science, logic, discovery, you know. But when we think about the pre-Socratic world, we must think that philosophers were most closer to mystics, to magicians. Many of these philosophers were seers, healers, prophets, you know. Empedocles is a wonder worker. Thales was attributed with miracles, was almost a divine being. You know, we have, for example, Epimenides of Crete, who purified the whole city. Like, imagine what a magical feat it must be. Oh, let me come and I'll purify the whole city. Wow, that's it. Or that, for example, he slept in a cave for 60 years. You know, so, and of course, this must be interpreted like a sort of mystical trance. Or maybe that he frequently went to caves to meditate, to stay by himself. So we must think as philosophy, as the rationalization of a mystical and spiritual experience. So for us, we may find in pre-Socratic philosophy a theoretical informative context for Goethea. And also, we can't exclude that what we find in philosophy will be the transcendent component of Goethea. You know, so we may imagine that this mystical, the seer, the sages first did the mystical experience. And then from this mystical experience, they wrote, they put down into their logical mind. They try to define the experience, and that is their philosophy. So this is the link between these two objects.
It's really interesting. I would love to learn more about that, but your essay touched on it just enough that it's given me a lot of tools and a lot of ideas to go and continue searching in that direction. So thank you so much for bringing that up in your essay. It was really interesting. Given all that you have learned then since you wrote this document, you've mentioned a few bits already that you've discovered some more things since you wrote this. But what's changed since you had this published, and how would you now go about answering the question, who are the Goetes? I know you've already had a really good crack at that earlier, but what's changed in your understanding in the past, 2 years?
Well, I still haven't put into a coherent frame, but when I wrote the essay, I was extra focused on the metallurgic aspects of this daimones and this connection to the Goetia. Today, I think they are relevant, but they are not so central, which is useful for people that don't feel this strong connection to the paradigm of metal, to putting Goetia other aspects, other themes, so to speak. And if I had to give a further definition of Goetia and what the Goethes do, I would like to answer. I think the only way I personally can answer this is not through a discourse, but by So to how can I say, tracing an image with words. So it's like describing a picture, you know? And when I think of a goddess, so a prediction of Goetia, I imagine someone who see the world as a single cosmos, full of wonder and possibilities. And he is part of it. He is part of this big living body. And to explore this cosmos, he traveled, learning a little here and there, in cities where writing flourish and creates laws, in forest where the rhythm of the drums elevates the soul to the gods, on sea, on the seas where the stars are close, or in caves where the breath of the ancients are whispered about ancient and hidden things, about the buried past. I imagine someone who melt metal to understand the nature of things, to delve into the world, to discover its secrets and the nature of matter, of the cosmos, and of the gods who compose it. I imagine someone who passes on his knowledge like a sower in the fields, leaving seed, scattering them as he travels, because they will grow and enrich the community, or generate another madman like him who sometimes will take the road and walks who knows where. So this is the picture I have in my head, but I can't translate into coherent word. I invite the listener to imagine, to visualize.
You painted a wonderful picture, though. That was excellent. And so how then can we adapt this historical information that you have brought to us into a modern practice?
Well, first of all, we today have all the techniques we need. For example, me personally, I'm currently reevaluating all my practice around this subject by using the books by Aidan Wachter, you know, Six Ways, because I think, for example, a very useful tool is chaos magic. Because after all, if you don't have a tradition, what you're doing is chaos magic. It may be informed by a tradition. Of course, we are speaking very broadly, but even if you work the grimoire, you are still doing chaos magic. It is informed by a tradition. You apply differently than most chaos magicians. A respect, a value to this tradition, but you are still going freestyle. And that's what we're doing. We are doing freestyle. So even if we look at ancient Greece, at the Greek magical papyri, to the grimoire or whatever, we are freestylers. So if you want to reach this, first you learn techniques and you can get them a lot. There are a lot of books. You can get them from chaos magic, from grimoire magic, from ceremonial magic, from Wicca, traditional witchcraft, whatever. Then you go back and you study history and you try, like I did before. You begin to form a picture in your head. You read myth, you make new myths by piecing together archaeology, ritual, evidence. You follow breadcrumbs into this rabbit hole, and at some point they will bring you somewhere. That's what I can say. No more. The rest is secrets and a personal experience. You can't communicate anything beside this.
I think I couldn't have put that any better myself. Absolutely spot on. Thank you for coming onto the show and talking to us today, Simone. It's been really good. But where can we learn more about this subject specifically? So you mentioned a couple of books already, and I will include those in the description. But do you have any other book recommendations that you would like to, point people towards, so they can flesh out their understanding and their knowledge of this subject?
Well, I'd say that, for example, for the Daimonus we spoke about, there is one seminal book that you have to get, which is Myth, Ritual, and Metallurgy in Ancient Greece and Recent Africa by Sandra Blakely. That's the cornerstone because she did an amazing work to synthesize and gather all the possible sources you have on this. And she also said ordered the book very clearly. So you have like the in the one of the first introductory paragraph, you have like, oh, the curetes are this, and this. The caberoi are this, and that. So it's clearly and wonderfully explained. And you have, with a very sensible anthropological approach, a cultural comparison with the links of metallurgy and spirituality that we have in the African, especially West Africa, which have shed lights on the function that this diamond had, and which I reported also in this interview. So I suggest to start from there, and then you have the bibliography, sorry, because bibliography in books is essential. Do not ignore it, like introduction and the footnotes. Please read footnotes.
Good, good. Okay. We mentioned before we started the interview as well. We have to talk about your new blog on Substack. So, you're covering some really interesting subjects, and you're currently working on a translation of BNF 1524. So, could you tell us a little bit about your progress in this, and what's your goal, your ultimate goal with this translation effort?
I'd like to discuss this manuscript because I believe it's important to discuss folk magic in medieval and Renaissance Europe. And also because there is one aspect that is rarely discussed in the actual diffusion of this grimoire. Let me explain. Even we occultists naively talk about grimoires as a tradition, but maybe they were practiced by 100 people over the span of 1,000 years. So, how can we call this a Western tradition? It was practiced maybe by 100 people. For another point is, for example, when we speak of philosophies, we say, oh, like in late antiquity, we have Neoplatonism. But how many people all across the Mediterranean actually knew about Neoplatonism? Very few.
Philosophers.
Yeah. So when we talk about tradition, I'd like to bring to the general public example of a witchcraft or a sorcery or magic, as we want to call them, that from its form, it seems to be more suited to a popular context. Like if I were to bet, is the Key of Solomon more spread as the sorcery we find in this manuscript? I will bet on the sorcery, because how can a common person afford all the material? How can that person afford in doing all this conjuration? How can they be memorized? Because mostly people couldn't read or write, so things had to be short because they had to be put into memory. How can you memorize a Solomonic conjuration? I couldn't. And BNF 1524 offer a very wide example of sorcery. Of he got spells, he got medicinal charms, psalm magic. There are a lot of different stuff that it seems more suitable for a wider diffusion.
And this is one of the oldest extant grimoires that we have, right?
Yeah, it's not a, yeah, it is,
It's
because
not quite a grimoire, it's proto-grimoire.
no, but for example, the last post-Aeneid, the one about that I call the Necromantia, that is the preface to all the love magic experiments I posted in other post. So that could be a booklet, about necromancy that start with a profession and say, oh, you people want to learn, then first you have to know this astrological timing, you have to do things accordingly to planetary hour and day, and then I present you examples. It is done. This and this and that. So you study the example because he calls them example. You study the example and then you make your own. So I'd say that is a grimoire. Very short, probably short because it was used to for other person because the speaker of this booklet he speak like he's teaching, you know. While usually we have they seems like notes to oneself, you know, the other grimoire. Instead, we know if you want to learn this, do this and that. So that is part of our Ubo's family lineage. I don't know. But I also have another surprise that I haven't still talked about because BNF is, we can say, sorcery from the 15th century. But I have managed to track an even earlier books, which is a folk magic books from the 13th century of Italy. And that's folk magic, pure folk magic, like very simple stuff, work with herbs, with materia magica. And I plan to also release this translation of these books because I think we need to reevaluate, you know, what we call the Western tradition, if we one day want to turn it into a living tradition. That is my experience in voodoo, that elitist stuff, it's hard to turn them into a tradition. You have to simplify, you have to make new stuff, you have to form them into a coherent and elegant and simple frame. So we need a grimoire, but we need also something more dirty, more down to the earth.
I would love that. Personally, I've stopped using the idea of a Western tradition entirely. I think it might serve us better if we instead say European tradition, and then we can use that as opposed to other traditions, right? So we have a European tradition, but we also have an Arabic tradition, right?
Oh, sure.
Right.
Yeah, I use the term improperly because for me it's hard to dictionary in English. It's not my main language, but yeah, it is because that it doesn't mean anything. Western doesn't
Western's
mean
useless.
anything.
It's a useless term, completely useless.
I'd even dare to say it's a dangerous term because it's filled with white culture, supremacism and bias. I mean, European, it's when you identify, if you say European, it's a territory. No, Europe is a continent, is a land. So you say the tradition of that continent. But Western, what is it? It's a bias, it's an idea of a civilization that doesn't exist because Western. Is there a civilization named Western? No. Dominican Republic is Western than Europe.
That's very
Is
far west.
that part of the Western tradition? Is Brazilian Kimbanda part of the Western tradition?
So I
Because
would.
often, yeah, because they because people who use this term often exclude this you know this cluster of tradition that often mix natives from America, mix the elements from Africa. They exclude it because often it's a I mean, let's face each other. When people often say Western tradition, it's like they're implying a white Western tradition.
Exactly, and
And I've said everything.
you're completely right to say that you think it's borderline dangerous. I agree. Yeah, so
Even in Goetia, it's saying it's a Greek tradition. It's wrong because the Western Mediterranean of the late Bronze Age was a deep network of connection. So, for example, if we examine myth of Eros, of Daimones, we see they often come from Phrygia, as we said before, from Phoenicia, even from Egypt. So their origin, their magic, it's all connected. Even Pythagoras, before going to Samothrace, He learned in Egypt. You know, we have the story of Saint Cyprian, who learned in Memphis, in Argos, in Chaldean. I mean, that the world was connected. So it's useless to limit to a geographical
area,
boundary,
yeah.
Especially if we go back in time and we don't know anything. I mean, if we speak about modern Greek folk tradition, that's another point. But when we go back in time, there is no point in these limits.
Excellent. Well, on that note, I think we will bring this really wonderful interview to an end. Thank you so much for coming on to the show today to talk about this subject, Simone. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I was glad to be here, and I'd like to say to the people, to the listener, that I have prepared like a text to answer the question, but I went totally in another way. So I'll post the answer in my blog so people can read even more of what I had prepared. Thank you so much.
That was Simon Baldacci, author of Mother, Daimones and Goetia, Ecstasy and Civilization, one of many fantastic essays on the very cutting edge of esoteric thought and practice found within Hadean Press's Conjure Codex series. I absolutely adored our conversation on the Goes, most especially the themes of cosmogony and the primordial water as molten copper. This offers such an incredible perspective on the nature of both metal and the Goes, and the way in which we engage with reality and myth. There is also the blurring of the distinct celestial and chthonic realms, and instead we find this far simpler expression, something far more universal, in which the stars are part of the underworld. This is exactly the sort of magical model I am so passionate about exploring and recovering from the past. I was also fascinated to hear about Simone's experiences with Voudon, and the many points of contact found in the European grimoire tradition, especially in the way we engage with the four parts of the world. If you haven't already read Simone's work, then I highly recommend that you check out his essay in Conjure Codex 5, and also look up his fantastic ongoing Substack project, Goetic Musings, which is linked in the description below. Thank you so much for listening this far. We would be so grateful if you would like and share this interview with other like-minded people. This will really support our work at Hadean Press and allow us to continue our ongoing project of spotlighting our global authorship. More to come soon. Thank you all, and I will see you all again in the next one.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.